Today we have a special visitor from the past. Someone who we all should know better, Margaret Fuller, has honored us today with her presence. And I'm going to invite Margaret to come forward and provide our opening words. Good to see you this morning, Margaret.
Let me stand in my age with all its waters flowing round me. If they sometimes subdue, they must finally upbear me, for I seek the universal, and that must be the best. Our hymn is written in honor of this special occasion and is on the separate sheets.
Thank you.
The chalice lighting is number 575. And is a responsive reading taken from Women in the 19th Century. A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
When man and woman regard one another as a brother and sister, able both to appreciate and to prophesy.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
What a woman needs is not as a woman to act or rule, but as a nature to grow, as an intelligence to discern, as a soul to live freely and unimpeded, to unfold such powers as were given her.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
Man does not have his fair share either. His energies are regressed and distorted by the interposition of artificial obstacles.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We would have every pathway open to woman as freely as to man.
Were this done, we believe a divine energy would pervade nature to a degree unknown in the history of former ages.
A new manifestation is at hand. A new hour is come.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I am greatly pleased to appear before you in this Unitarian Society on the august occasion of the commemoration of 200 years since my birth. I had always conceived that I was not born for the common lot, and I am heartened to see that after 200 years, I have been proved correct. Being here in the Unitarian Society reminds me that my grandfather, being a minister, and my parents quite pious, I spent many Sunday mornings in church. In those days, of course, sermons could last several hours. I devised many mental occupations to employ my mind during those lengthy speeches. I pray you will not need to resort to such employment this morning. In preparation for my visit with you, I have perused several issues of your recent newsletters and periodicals. And I would like to recommend to any who are not able to be here today an excellent article about me in the current UU world and one of the more flattering images of myself. I am both delighted and dismayed to see from my readings that human nature has changed so little that we may converse on topics of importance. Many of your concerns today are the same as those that occupied me in my circle of acquaintances almost 200 years ago. I am, however, dismayed to find that so little progress has been achieved in some of the areas of concern to me. I apprehend from your writings that there is now great debate on the culture of the Unitarian and a topic which you call spirituality. Likewise, in my time, the same debate split apart the Unitarian Church. In my youth in the early 1800s, the Unitarian movement came to a head under its spokesman, who was also my friend and neighbor, Reverend William Ellery Channing. His teachings proposed rationalism and humanism in opposition to the Calvinist doctrines of predestination and original sin. By 1820, an entire group of churches in Massachusetts under Channing's leadership accepted the name Unitarian. Channing's belief in the perfectibility of the human race led his followers to support the many reform movements that were then springing up: prison reform, education reform, temperance, abolition, women's rights, and so on. Unitarianism was in the center of intellectual ferment in Massachusetts in the 1820s and 30s, my youth, in the persons of Theodore Parker, George Ripley, and my dear friend Waldo, Mr. Ralph Waldo Emerson. The new liberal Unitarianism was already hardening into its own orthodoxy, confining to free spirits such as dear Waldo. He and his circle, of which I became one, in reaction to the established church, defined the movement which became known as Transcendentalism. This name came from the belief that the divine is transcendent or present in all of nature. Our group felt that the established church was too coldly intellectual and too removed from human and natural experience. The main tenets of transcendentalism include the essential unity of all creation, which we can observe in nature, the supremacy of insight over logic as a source of deepest truths, and the perfectibility of humankind. Although we were highly trained in logic and classical Western thought and respectful of those traditions, we sought as well the mysticism to be found in direct personal experience. My reading of Kant, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Goethe introduced me to an emotional and mystical world of the soul. Goethe portrayed humans and nature alike as extensions of the divine and showed me that all moments of life can be holy. One must live actively in each moment. Do these ideas sound familiar to you? I understand that here in the 21st century, you are once again rediscovering the concept of the soul, the interrelation of humans and nature, and the sacredness of everyday life. We also kept our minds open to a variety of experiences by experimenting with seances and mesmerism, which you call hypnotism, and exploring the properties of gems and flowers. I understand that in your time also, some people seek to find answers through herbs and crystals. I've learned from my study of your bulletins and periodicals that you sponsor various classes. One is called Building Your Own Theology, and part of that work requires you to describe moments of high spiritual meaning in your life. I had in my life a number of such moments, one particularly striking, and it happened, ironically, just after leaving a church service. It was Thanksgiving Day, 1831. I was 21 and was obliged to go to church or exceedingly displease my father. I almost always suffered much in church from a feeling of disunion with the hearers and dissent from the preacher. But today, more than ever before, the services jarred upon me. I felt within myself a great power and generosity and tenderness, but it seemed to me as if they were all unrecognized, and it was impossible that they should be used in life. There was at this time no schooling, no profession, and no station in life open to me, save that of wife, governess, or companion. I was only 1 in 20. The past was worthless, the future hopeless, yet I could not remember ever voluntarily to have done a wrong thing, and my aspiration seemed very high. I looked around the church and envied all the little children, for I suppose they would never know this strange anguish. I was in haste for all to be over, that I might get into the free air. I walked away over the fields as fast as I could. It was a sad and sallow day of the late autumn. Slow processions of sad clouds were passing over a cold blue sky. The hues of earth were dull and gray and brown, with sickly struggles of late green here and there. Sometimes a moaning gust of wind drove late reluctant leaves across the path. There was no life else. I went on and on, till I came to where the trees were thick about a little pool, dark and silent. I sat down there. I did not think. All was dark and cold and still. Suddenly the sun shone out with that transparent sweetness, like the last smile of a dying lover, which it will use when it has been unkind all a cold autumn day. And even then, passed into my thought a beam from its true sun, which has never since departed from me. I saw that there was no self, that it was only because I thought self real that I suffered, that I had only to live in the idea of the all, and all was mine. My earthly pain at not being recognized never went deep after this hour. At least so I wrote it by journal. I must admit to you, however, that I still despaired, still struggled to achieve some recognition, and still kept a definite sense of self. In fact, some thought I bore an inordinately large quantity of self. I often found solace in the company of others, yet I also retained my passion for nature. My head wrapped in my shawl, I would listen to the music of the earth, then raise my head and look straight into the secrets of heaven. My garden was my eternal consolation for the endless drudgery of housekeeping and supervising my younger siblings. Thus, I attempted to navigate the treacherous waters of my spiritual journey. I see that your church sponsors a committee of religious education and that public education is, in your time, a major concern. I feel I am eminently qualified to comment upon these subjects as both pupil and teacher. My father instructed me himself. I was the firstborn, and he applied to me the education he would have given to a son. I was put at once under discipline of considerable severity and had more than ordinarily high standards presented to me. He hoped to make me the heir of all he knew. Thus, I had tasks given to me, as many and various as the hours would allow, and on subjects beyond my age. I was often kept up till very late, and as he was a severe teacher, my feelings were kept on the stretch till the recitations were over. My father had no conception of the subtle motions of imagination and feeling which were the natural tenets of my character. At the age of 6, I was set to reading and memorizing Latin. The subjects of my study were the Roman wars and the monsters of mythology. Their unnatural influence on my tender years caused many nightmares. I became a somnambulist, a sleepwalker, and suffered from excruciating headaches which would plague me my entire life. What have I gained by my precocity? I have never been happy. I am confident that I should have been much better off had sense, intellect, and passion been brought out in the natural order. I had no natural childhood. I do wish that I had lived with toys and played in the open air. Children should expand in the sun and let thoughts come to them. They should not, through books, antedate their actual experiences, but should take them gradually. With me, much of life was devoured in the bud. When at 10 years old, I first entered school with other young ladies, my unusual upbringing and bookish vocabulary set me immediately apart. I was nearsighted and had developed a pronounced squint. I was tall for my age and suffered from a disturbed complexion. In these years between 10 and 16, I made up my mind to be bright and ugly. I easily captured academic honors, but found much more difficult the expectations for behavior of a young lady. As I had been raised in my early years to display my knowledge and wit, it was hard to acquire the modest deportment my father now requested. Apparently, my father had never considered to what end he was instilling in me his classical education. I was unable, because of my sex, to enter Harvard as my brothers did. I was unable to support myself by a literary life or a career, as young women may in your era. I could not aspire to be a minister, a lawyer, a professor, or a doctor. My only choices were to marry and raise children, to become a governess and care for the children of others, or perhaps to teach other people's children. I remained at home. My father retired from his career as state and later federal representative to live out his dream of becoming a gentleman farmer. However, our financial situation was extremely strained, and family tragedies soon struck us. Several of the children became ill, and my infant brother died in my arms. My mother was so grief-stricken that she withdrew for a time from all household affairs, leaving me, at age 16, to supervise the cooking, cleaning, and laundry for the household of 7, without, I add, any of your modern conveniences, as well as educating the younger children. In spite of all the difficulties, I continued to read and study on my own in the scant moments available, and even projected to write a biography of my beloved Goethe. For this purpose, I intended to travel to Europe and imbibe the cultures that had so influenced me already. but increasing poverty and illness in the family prevented the fruition of my dream. Circumstances decided that I must not go to Europe and shut down upon me the door to the scenes I could have loved. At present, I wrote to a friend, I feel no confidence or hope. The future brightened for me, however, thanks to my new acquaintance with Mr. Emerson. In his home, I found wit, charm, and the companionship of intellectual equals. Another common frequenter of Waldo Emerson's home was the young radical Bronson Alcott. He had recently embarked on the venture of an alternative school in Boston, which sought to educate by kindness and the Socratic method, rather than by the stick and endless repetition, as was the usual case. The school was held in such disrepute by many Bostonians that the assistant, Miss Peabody, felt compelled to resign. I had perhaps fewer qualms or more need for the salary, for I decided to take the position. Although I had never seen myself as a teacher, I felt that if I must teach to support myself, this would be the ideal place to do so. The methods of the Temple School, as it was called, were diametrically opposed to the exacting education I myself had received. We were perhaps the first in the country to incorporate light and color into the schoolroom, to involve children as active participants in their own education. Apparently, Boston was not ready for such innovation. Alcott received such scathing attacks for his unorthodox methods that enrollment dwindled rapidly, and after 1 year, he was unable to pay my salary. The school subsisted several more years, until in 1839, he was forced to close for committing the ultimate disgrace of admitting a mulatto girl. Alcott went on to found a commune, which was established on principles of high thinking and frugal eating, but which quickly failed as well. In fact, his family was only pulled from poverty by the writings of his daughter, Louisa May Alcott. I understand that in your time, you still read her books, especially Little Women. You will note that although the story is largely modeled on Louisa's girlhood in Concord, a town where I also lived, her father has disappeared from the book. She makes the Mr. March eminently respectable, unlike her father, the wild-eyed prophet of Concord. And for good measure, she banishes him conveniently to the war. Another item of interest to me in current day is the existence of discussion groups for women. You are no doubt unaware that I was the first to popularize discussion groups, or conversations as I called them, exclusively for women. This provided a much needed supplement to my income, gave me an enjoyable avenue of development for myself, and improved the outlook of other women. I perceived many women hungry for knowledge of languages, literature, and history, which was readily available to men. My groups were designed not only to educate women, but to change their view of themselves. Women had been taught that their brains were actually inferior to those of men, but I provided an example that the true difference lay only in education. In my groups, women were encouraged to formulate and express opinions on such subjects as art, health, and philosophy. This was a special delight to me, as I had always sparkled in conversation. I write well, but never so well as I talk, for then I feel inspired, and the means are pleasant. My voice excites me, my pen never. Would that I could have lived in the era of talk radio and television panel discussions. Waldo Emerson said of me, "You cannot predict her opinion. She sympathizes so fast with all forms of life that she talks never narrowly or hostilely, nor betrays like all the rest, under a thin garb of new words, the old droning cast iron opinions." Although he once felt it necessary to remind me that adjectives come in degrees, of which the superlative is only one, he also called me a joyful guest who brought wit, anecdotes, love stories, tragedies, oracles with her. Her arrival was a holiday, and he admitted that I made him laugh more than he liked. Waldo admired intelligent women, but they should not challenge too many of his opinions. Like many of my gentleman friends, he believed the best of women's minds must yet be inferior to the best of men's. And like them, he married a woman who was quiet and refined, who offered no challenge to his superiority, and who provided the household support, which I, as a spinster, never had. I had no one to run the house and provide for my well-being while I devoted myself to my writings. Although some of your scholars claim that I attempted unsuccessfully to attract Waldo to myself in a more particular manner and withdrew it hurt when I failed, our relationship was more complex than that. He and I were intimate of mind, if never of body. We shared our newest writings and ideas with each other and argued frequently over our opinions. Waldo's wife, Lydian, did go so far as to burst into tears one day in response to the amount of time Waldo and I spent together. But then she laid the blame on her nerves. I thought it all over, whether I was considerate enough. As to my being more his companion, I reflected, that cannot be helped. His life is in the intellect, not the affections. He has affection for me, but it is because I quicken his intellect. Several times in my life, in fact, I found myself ready to offer ultimate devotion to a gentleman, but they always found my personality and intelligence overwhelming. In fact, on 3 separate occasions, as I attempted to deepen my relationship with a particular gentleman, he hastily departed and soon engaged himself to marry another. Not only men did I love, for it is so true that a woman may be in love with a woman and a man with a man. How natural was my love for Anna Barker. I loved Anna for a time, I think, with as much passion as I was then strong enough to feel. Her face was always gleaming before me. Her voice was echoing in my ear. All poetic thoughts clustered around the dear image. She loved me too, but more tenderly, less passionately. Then again, that night, when she leaned on me and her eyes were such a deep violet blue, and we both felt such a strange mystic thrill and knew what we had never known before. And yet, Anna married Sam Ward, one of the very gentlemen I cared for myself. Thus, I lost both. I decided I should remain alone for life and wrote, "No one loves me, but I love many a great deal. Strong feelings require strong expression. I am called too fiery. I wish to be seen as I am and would lose all rather than soften away anything. From a very early age, I have felt that I was not born to the common womanly lot. I knew I should never find a being who could keep the key of my character, that there would be none on whom I could always lean. A man's ambition with a woman's heart, 'tis an accursed lot. With the intellect, I always have, always shall overcome, but that is not half the work. The life, oh my God, shall the life never be sweet?" But I digress. I wish to discuss a further point of similarity between us. I have heard the editor of your newsletter sometimes needs to beg for your contributions. Well, do I know the editor's plea. In 1839, the Transcendentalist Club proposed the idea of a journal to be named The Dial. And since Emerson refused the position of editor, it fell to me. I described the journal to William Henry Channing as a perfectly free organ to be offered for the expression of individual thought and character. Each month, I was compelled to coax the Transcendentalists for articles, and even with that, I must needs provide the largest part of many issues myself. We wrote on literature, philosophy, and society. Our periodical received mixed reviews. The eminent Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, blamed all of the Dial's faults on the unusual gender of its editor, saying, "The chief thing wrong with the Dial was that it needed a beard." But Among its supporters, the journal was gladly received. During my 2 years as editor, I strove for vitality rather than technical perfection. I did, however, manage to offend both Alcott and Thoreau by requesting revisions to their work. After this episode of my life, my writing assumed new forms. In the summer of 1843, I undertook a great journey to the American Northwest, to the ultimate ends of civilized existence, Milwaukee. I observed the wonder of Niagara Falls and bemoaned the fact, already in 1843, that it was being surrounded by buildings for the accommodation of visiting tourists. My account, published under the title Summer on the Lakes, was more than a travelogue. I discussed themes of social issues which much occupied my thoughts. I'm glad to see that in your time, you sponsor activities of social action, and that you have made progress in many areas, and yet in some ways you resemble still the world I knew. On my journey, I saw remnants of Indian tribes whose world was fast disappearing, and who, from proud keepers of the land, were reduced to sickly beggars. On my return, I took up abode in New York and published articles for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. I visited prisons, poorhouses, and insane asylums. In my columns, I called for reform in attitude as well as in institutions. Around this time, I also published a book, which had grown from an earlier article in the Dial. I had called the original article The Great Lawsuit and stated the radical notion that all souls are equal, free, slave, Indian, white, male, and female. My book was entitled Woman in the 19th Century. In this book, I encouraged women to postpone marriage until they had developed a sense of themselves. I recommended that women be economically independent and not socially pressured to get married. I advocated that all professions be open to women. We would have every arbitrary barrier thrown down and would have every path laid open to women as freely as to man. If you ask me what offices women may fill, I reply, any. I do not care what case you put. Let them be sea captains, if you will. Today you might say astronauts or president, but in my time, sea captains were the epitome of masculine adventure. People were shocked that a spinster of 34 years should discuss the sexual double standard as I did. Men were allowed total freedom because of their insatiable needs. Women were to be ignorant of such passions and unyielding to these insatiable men until they married, after which they must submit implicitly to their husbands. The least appearance of coldness in the wife is wicked, because liable to turn her husband's thought to illicit indulgence. Any transgressions by the husband, then, were considered the fault of the wife. The educational system, I wrote a century and a half ago, must give girls as fair a field as boys, perhaps a level playing field. Too much is said of women being educated that they may become better companions and mothers for men. Not one man in the million can rise above the belief that woman was made for man. Each woman must lay aside all thought of being taught and led by men. Even the well-meaning males who seemed so glad to esteem women whenever they could would never in any extreme of despair wish they were women. After over a century of reforms in education, suffrage, and law, I am sad to learn that this perception is still a central barrier to true equality. For even in your time, how many men would wish to be a woman? Yet man can never be truly free until woman is also. We are one. There is no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman. And May 23rd, 2010, an article talking about the appearance of women. And although there are 16 senators who are women, not one gray hair must ever be seen among them. Another article mentioning the discussions on whether a Supreme Court justice should be married, have children, or not. And a young woman who is under threat of death for her life because she has opposed the patriarchal nature of Islamic religion. We have not yet attained the new manifest. I will close by telling you of the happy ending and the tragic conclusion of my life story. In 1846, at the age of 36, I finally was able to visit England, France, and my beloved Italy, the country where I found I belonged. The Italians sympathized with my character and understood my organization as no other people ever did. They admired the ready eloquence of my nature and highly prized my intelligent sympathy with their sufferings. Here was a land of passion and grandeur so different from the cold proprieties of New England. In this magical atmosphere, I experienced one day my own Italian adventure. Separated by accident from my traveling companions, I was rescued and accompanied by a charming young man who turned out to be an impoverished nobleman. He, like myself, cherished strong sympathies for the Republican movement in Italy led by Mazzini, whom I had met and befriended in London. Perhaps it was the freedom from American conventions which allowed me to engage in a happy liaison with my dear Giovanni Assoli. Scholars still debate whether he and I were quietly married before or after the birth of our son in the tumultuous year of 1848. I shall not spoil the debate by divulging the truth of the matter today. I endured the siege of Rome and visited wounded soldiers in the hospital while sending dispatches to the New York Tribune. Thus, I became the first female war correspondent. As news of my marriage and child reached home, it was greeted with great disapproval. The very individuals who had censured me for not marrying and fulfilling my womanly role now denounced me as licentious. I had married a foreigner and under dubious circumstances. In my happiness, I ignored their opinions, but my idol was not to last. My family's financial situation had improved but little, and my voyage had been financed through loans from a number of friends and relations. Although I had convinced Greeley to pay me twice the usual rate for my columns, I could no longer afford to remain abroad. Our voyage home on the small bark Elizabeth was ill-omened from the first. After a week at sea, the captain became ill. We were forced to harbor at Gibraltar, where he died of smallpox. My little son contracted this fearsome disease, and none save I believed he could survive. I refused to give up hope, and indeed, he recovered. But on the morning of our arrival in New York Harbor, the first mate, who was now in charge, made a tragic miscalculation. The ship was driven onto a large sandbar off Long Island, pounded by huge waves. As light dawned, we could see figures on the beach, but all our lifeboats had been destroyed, and there was no way to reach us. Some passengers contrived to swim ashore with the assistance of wooden planks, but I refused to leave my child and could not bear him through the waves. That afternoon, when the tide came in, the ship broke up, and the rest of us were thrown overboard. Our bodies were never recovered, and neither was my manuscript for a book on the Italian Revolution. I was but 2 months past my 40th birthday. Emerson sent his friend Thoreau to look for any remains, but nothing was found. Emerson lamented, "I have lost in her my audience." The world lost also a voice that would have contributed to the burgeoning women's movement. At the first National Women's Rights Convention in October of that very year, the delegates observed a moment of silence in memory of the woman to whom they had hoped to confide the leadership of this movement. Yet my voice has been carried on by others. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony wrote in their History of Women's Suffrage, "Margaret Fuller possessed more influence upon the thought of American women than any woman previous to her time." I am proud to see as well that future Unitarians, such as you, carry on my voice in your quest for spiritual meaning, equality, and justice. And now my alter ego, Robin, will encourage you to have questions and discussion. say a moment, say one thing about how I came to do this and about what Margaret seems to mean to a number of us. Before moving here 8 years ago, my husband Dan and I belonged to a small group about this size outside the Twin Cities, and we had a tradition for a while where once a month a member would present on a famous Unitarian, and some of these were quite interesting and some were the most boring things you ever want to hear. So when I actually went to a citywide UU meeting there that involved several churches and someone briefly mentioned something about Margaret, I started finding out about her, and I decided that no one would fall asleep during my presentation. And I did this at several of the churches around the Twin Cities. Afterwards, I found there is a woman named Lori James, who is a UU, who has actually done a professional tour where she depicted Margaret, both on her own and with Emerson. And she's going to be doing her program at the General Assembly. There are also going to be several sessions devoted to Margaret at the General Assembly. But as you'll see in that UU World article, there's something about Margaret that has encouraged many people to rediscover her in this last 10, 15 years, and to be amazed that she's not better known and that she does sort of take us over. Most of what I spoke were her words, of course, and there remains a lot of journals and letters that we can draw from, and it's amazing how apt a number of things still are. Well, I should also mention that I've mentioned before when just about all of these women I've talked about, Louisa May Alcott and the Peabody sisters and some others, that the same thing happened to Margaret, that right after her death, she was kind of prettied up by people who wrote about her and called her Mrs. Ossoli, which wasn't the title she went by, and tried to tone her down a bit, and that it's really, I would say, in the feminist era that she was rediscovered. And some of these things she said were quite outrageous at the time, that women could not only vote but be legislators, and that women could have any career no matter what. It was very unheard of. And the whole idea of the conversations, that people really believed that a woman's brain was naturally inferior, and she was able to say, well, if they had the education that I had, they would have exactly the same abilities that men who have that education have. So she was way ahead of her time. Well, she did charge a fee for these programs that women came to. And I think some of our visitors knew more about that as far as how many women actually attended. They were held in the bookshop run by Elizabeth Peabody, by the way, first woman to run a bookstore, and someone that we've learned about here. So she charged fees for that and was able to make as much doing that as she had teaching, which was not very well paid, but she needed to do something to help support herself and her family. She also did write. She wrote quite a bit for magazines and newspapers. She could be considered the first literary critic or one of the first of any gender. And some of the topics that she wrote on, the article in the UU World says first public intellectual, and she was able to receive some pay for that. She also had a lot of people who were not happy about her. She got a lot of the same comments that someone like Eleanor Roosevelt got, saying, she's not really a woman. And who was it, Carlyle? Who was it that said there are three categories, men, women, and Margaret Fuller? And that's where that's the title of Lori James's program, actually. So, you know, people did not always appreciate her passions. Yeah, I think they did have a good turnout, and a number of the Unitarian women were the ones who attended. Some of the wives of ministers and other movers and shakers. It was the Boston area. This might not have worked somewhere else, but Boston was liberal in that sense, and there was great regard for education. And I suppose it was not threatening to men because it was just women talking. And our friends did remind us last night that she did open it up to men at one time, and it didn't work very well because the men spent a lot of time trying to impress each other and sort of took over. So she had a grand nephew named Buckminster Fuller, who you may know. Yeah. And one of the books that I read went into a little more detail about what she had to do all this housework. Basically, her mother apparently fell into depression after the baby died and was incapacitated for some time. And some of you that know some things about colonial history or the West or anything about women's lives, how much work it was to heat water, to wash clothes, and to keep a house clean, and to bake bread, and to take care of all these children. And then on the side, study German and translate Goethe and write many letters and so on. It's really quite impressive. Right, that's right. They made their own clothes, made their own candles, soap, all these things that were not available. And where someone like Emerson had a household, and he had the status too that he was able to have servants, and of course he had his wife to keep things going for him. Some of her writings were preserved in letters because she left them behind in Europe, and so they were not, they did not get lost with the ship like her manuscript did. And because she corresponded with a number of famous people, like Emerson, some of those letters were kept as well. And and as far as her relationship with her husband, when she was in Italy, it was the same time that Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Robert Browning were there, and Elizabeth Barrett Browning said they made an excellent couple because she talked and he listened. Because this young man, he was about 10 years younger than she was. He wasn't intimidated by her. He wasn't an intellectual. And so in a way, maybe she found a wife. You know, that is, she found a support. He was very devoted to the Republican cause in Italy, and that was something that she also was very engaged in. But it was kind of unexpected that at that, she never thought that she would have that that side of her life fulfilled. Yes, it was the Margaret, her husband, and the baby all drowned. And the idea that they were just off the coast. So that's where the UU World said, it's amazing that she hasn't. And my kids said this back when I first did this. My kids were in junior high, I think, or high school. Said they should make a movie of her life, Ma, because they have that Titanic thing, you know. Well, and over a long time, history was the province of men. That was how it was done. And Margaret stayed within she was in the intellectual tradition. Her writings are rather flowery and long-winded, might seem to us, not so much her letters and journals, but for instance, Women in the 19th Century, she makes all kinds of allusions to classical life, and it's not the easiest for us to approach, but that was the way to write an intellectual book. But apparently it did sell quite well and was well-known at the time. And yet, I think even in she certainly isn't known in the feminist community, or wasn't in the 70s, the way somebody like Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and some of the others were. But that's the interesting thing. If she had not died at that time, she could have been the leader of this new movement, and that would have been very interesting to observe.
Thank you.
May truth, unpolluted by prejudice, vanity, or selfishness, be granted daily more and more as the due inheritance and only valuable conquest for us all.